seachtain an Indo-Ascaliger.
Táim I mon iarachtaí a dhéanamh teacht ar a chorp, agus súlagam amach an seo gur féidir é a chur in uaig ceart lena bhaintir féin.
Scíltaí, fios, tuairimí.
Tá sé dochreite nach bhféadfach ara i gcuirna meáin an cheist sin a eicáil.
Bhí an talam a gnám go raibh orthcháir in reachtam. Iadach sé tarann go raibh an orthcháir san i lis dúthail agus go mina fnacht gáir a chlig sár ducha sin éair. Ná ní bhíon ann tar d'oraach sé sin. Vin Marav.
Shachtan. Find us on all the usual podcast platforms.
Yeah, having my head shoved into the steps of the Ulster Bank in Ranelagh, called butt of a gun put into the back of your skull, that's a moment where you go, okay, yeah, I think this one's up.
How does a high-flying academic become one of Ireland's most prolific bank robbers?
What I would see is the most important part of this still lies open.
I'm Not Here to Hurt You, a brand new series from the award-winning team behind the Indo Daily.
That November day, that's where it all begins.
Out now, wherever you get your podcasts.
This is an Irish independent podcast.
It was just at the time where free apps became the norm. So in the early stages of the App Store, probably people don't even remember it, but people would pay like €5 or even as much as €20 for certain apps. People would just buy apps as a digital item. Our app, which was called Leonardo's Cat, was based around that model where literally we created a game, you bought the game. And in the time it took for us to develop the title, which was about a year, maybe a little longer, the market had completely shifted to free-to-play games, download for free, buy gems, that kind of thing. And it's very difficult to take a premium game that is designed to be sold as a single unit and reverse engineer that to be a free-to-play. So it was just the wrong business model by the time it came out. I would say that was fundamental. The issue with it.
Hello and you're welcome to the Big Tech Show with me, Adrian Weckler. Now, in the world of Irish gaming and digital illustration, StoryToys stands out as one of the more successful recent startups, working with giants such as Lego before being acquired for well over €20 million. And it has regularly been cited as one of the top 10 biggest kids app producing companies in the world. But it's been a colourful, at times precarious journey with disappointment and failure featuring more than once. To tell me how flirting with disaster happened occasionally, my guest this week is Emmett O'Neill, who's CEO of StoryToys. Emmett, you didn't start StoryToys, but you left a comfortable, steady job in online education over 10 years ago to join it, eventually becoming its CEO. What made you do that?
I guess I've moved around a lot in my career and I've worked across, I've always followed areas that interested me. So, you know, a passion for filmmaking turns into a year or two working with Element Pictures. An interest in advertising and how advertising work resulted in, you know, a year setting up a studio for Rothko. So I've always kind of followed my passion. And within the educational company that I was working in, apps were a tiny, tiny part of what I was doing. Steve Jobs had just introduced the iPad, you know, to cast your memory back. And I was operating huge budgets, had a huge team. We were making, I think $20 million a year worth of video content. We were making huge learning management systems for courseware. We were doing massive things at a massive scale. One tiny sliver of my job was making kids' apps. And I absolutely loved it.
And it was Hodder Stoughton that you were working for.
Houghton Mifflin Harcourt.
Houghton Mifflin Harcourt. Sorry, that's right. Which I think was originally, and I was at Riverdeep.
So Riverdeep did a reverse acquisition.
Reverse acquisition.
Yeah. So there was a tie-in, and I was working there at an interesting and kind of slightly chaotic period.
Yeah. That's a good description, actually. Now, but early success for StoryToys, it involved a collaboration with the hit 1970s young kids book, The Very Hungry Caterpillar, which was then turned into games, digital animation, right?
Yeah, so we basically, I suppose, when you're working in licensing, you know, you're really asking somebody to trust you with their brand. And when you take something as beloved as The Hungry Caterpillar, which hasn't really been translated into many animated products or games or anything like that. It's a huge leap of faith, I guess, on both parties. You know, the Story Toys is making the leap of faith that we could sell apps with the Hungry Caterpillar. They're making the leap of faith that we'll be respectful of the with the content that we make. So, yeah, it was a big step for us to land that brand.
But that was quite a success.
Absolutely, yeah. So we're still working with Penguin Random House, and we're still putting out new content for our Hungry Caterpillar apps. Yeah, the app, it was one of our early successes in 2015. We picked up pretty much every kid's prize available. We then released an augmented reality version of that app in the very early stages, I guess, of the tech that eventually became the Apple Vision Pro.
Vision Pro.
But we were working like with beta software in Cupertino to bring the Caterpillar to life in an AR way. And Apple really, really supported the work we were doing. Myself and my brother Barry at the time, you know, we got to kind of demo it to a lot of press in the US. And Apple had basically just picked really three companies to work with to showcase what you could do with AR. There was IKEA, The Walking Dead, and us. And so we were in strange company, but certainly, yeah, we got great support from Apple at that point in time. And to be fair, the apps were commercially successful and are commercially successful too.
And this was a very buzzy time for you and the company. And I remember the buzz around the company at the time. Story Toys then saw a chance, I think, to invest more on a puzzle game involving Patrick Stewart as the leading voice. With such a big star on board, it must have seemed like a really exciting project. First of all, how did you get Patrick Stewart to do it? And then why didn't it really work out?
Sure. It's a fair question. And what I would say is, before Patrick Stewart was on board, we had tremendous talent creatively behind it. So we had a New York Times award-winning journalist as the writer, a guy called Bob Tedeschi, who'd picked up the Apple App Prize and the previous year. We had Michael Frith, who was the designer of pretty much any Muppet that Jim Henson didn't design. And he was our character designer. We had some great comedy writers working on it. Like it was just a phenomenal team all around.
So you were this was your stable of talent that you were able to talk about.
Yeah. And I guess in Story Toys at the time, we were reaching out in a lot of different directions, trying to find the way forward for success. And we kind of thought, okay, we were struggling for our original IP to succeed at the time. So we thought, well, if you're going to make original IP, bring in all-star talent and see how that works out. And as you've alluded to, it didn't necessarily reap the rewards we thought it might.
And when I said that, what I really meant was that it didn't make a revenue return.
Yeah, no, it didn't. It didn't. So ultimately, what we were caught with on that one was, it was just at the time where free apps became the norm. So in the early stages of the App Store, probably people don't even remember it, but people would pay like €5 or even as much as €20 for certain apps. People would just buy apps as a digital item.
I think there was one app which was called, correct me if I'm wrong, it was called Stinking Rich or something.
I Am Rich. $800. Yeah.
I think 10 people bought it.
And it was an image of a diamond or something like that. Yeah. So these were times when people paid for apps, you know, maybe not $800, but certainly, you know, on a frequent basis, 10, 20, etc. So our app, which was called Leonardo's Cat, was based around that model where literally we created a game, you bought the game. And in the time it took for us to develop the title, which was about a year, maybe a little longer, the market had completely shifted to free-to-play games, download for free, buy gems, that kind of thing. And it's very difficult to take a premium game that is designed to be sold as a single unit and reverse engineer that to be a free-to-play. So it was just the wrong business model by the time it came out. I would say that was fundamentally the issue with it.
But otherwise, I'm sure you were very pleased with it.
I thought it was a great app. Yeah. I remain proud of it. And the fact that I'm still talking about it many years later would suggest I certainly had fun making it too, you know.
And around that point, I think the company wanted to branch out from very young kids, which had been its mainstay, you know, under sevens and eights, and address maybe an older children's market. You acquired a couple of companies to help you do this. Now, I've heard you talk before about the period around this time, about how the company got into financial trouble. What happened?
it was over a lengthy enough period of time. I suppose we were looking at the kids app space. And so my brother, who was the CEO at the time, Barry, he had a sound thesis in terms of what our kids app business should be. And we were approaching it from every angle that we could. But ultimately, we weren't getting there as quickly as we were spending investor money. So the strategy became, well, let's explore other areas. Let's look at middle school kids. Let's look at educational content for adults. And so we started looking in a lot of different directions and took on board a substantial amount of investor money at that point in time. That would have been the sort of the Series A. And we basically did a merger with one company and then acquired the portfolio of another company. So suddenly, instead of just producing content for, you know, eight and under, we were suddenly producing content from sort of 2 years old right the way up to adult. And I guess our goal was, by having a more diverse portfolio of content, that basically after somebody was done with the Story Toys content, you could introduce them to the preteen content, then teenage, and then sort of basically provide a library of content for people for life. So again, I think not a bad idea, you know?
Yeah. And how did that work out?
Well, I guess, looking back with 2020 hindsight, you know, we went in too many directions at the one time. And what we were really good at was making kids content, and more specifically making licensed kids content. But we pursued these other areas. As soon as a kid is really 7, 8 plus, they become significantly less influenced by their parents and more influenced by peers. So it's a notoriously difficult audience to market to. And I think we were, you know, appropriately startup, optimistically naive about what that would take. And we spent a lot of money really on trying to crack the marketing side of how you engage with that audience. But the other huge problem with the portfolio we had was we actually managed to get Apple to change policy and allow for a subscription in one app to unlock content in another app. So basically, if anybody downloaded any of the apps in our portfolio and subscribed, they accessed all of them. But Apple had done such a good job of educating people about the walled garden approach, that once you're in an app, it's just an app and it's a safe environment and it doesn't communicate with anything else. That, I mean, I don't know, I couldn't count the number of customer reviews we got saying, what? I just subscribed and I only get one app? Nobody realized the sort of the value proposition that you were subscribing to a portfolio. That was really hard to convey. Now, I think these days, you know, with Apple Arcade and all of those different subscription services, people are well used to this. But at the time, we were the first party doing this on the App Store and had literally got Apple to change policy to do so. But consumers were left baffled by it. So I think those were the biggest challenges that we had.
Okay. And I think at one point, famously, as you've said before, the board told you needed to liquidate.
So we were doing weekly board meetings, or even daily for periods of time, where they were assessing the business as a going concern. And it was effectively the board hit the point where their patience was running out. And Barry, as CEO, responsibly contacted liquidators and assessed all the options.
Okay. All right. But then something kind of remarkable happened, courtesy of an email from Lego.
Yeah. So during this really difficult time, and at this time, you know, we were downsizing, we were letting people go. And, you know, over the course of my career, I've kind of built really close relationships with a lot of people. And a lot of those people, my friends, were employees. So we were rapidly reducing the size of the team. And it was a really, really difficult time. Barry was doing everything to keep kind of funds going, to keep everybody basically paid on a monthly basis, as any stressed out CEO will know can be a challenge in a startup. And yeah, an email arrived in from Lego. Hello, we're working on a new project. Would you be interested in pitching for it? So, you know, pitching is an expensive and speculative thing, and we weren't and are not a work for hire business. So it felt very wrong, but it felt like a bit of a lifeline and something worth exploring. And critically, Lego also said, we will pay you to participate in this process.
Wow.
So it was a 6-week pitching process and they funded it. So it was like instantly, well, it's a little bit of revenue and there can't be any harm in exploring it. So I talked to the Lego group and I just said, look, we don't do work for hire, but we'd love to make this under license. So if we're successful in this, we'd love you to consider it as a licensed product. And they said, look, get to that point in the process first. So when it came down to producing a document to convince them that we were the right party, instead of producing that document, or actually as well as producing that document, we produced a fully featured prototype on device. So literally,
were they expecting that?
Not at all. It wasn't a requirement. And it's a pretty incredible thing to turn around in the course of, I think it was 5 weeks we worked on the prototype for. But we basically produced something not dissimilar to the products that we ultimately created for them. So when you're dealing with a paper-based proposal to a brief versus, oh, okay, that's it working, that's what we wanted to see, suffice to say, we won the contract.
Because you were in competition. You won that contract with Lego. I mean, Lego are, you know, they're up there with Marvel and with all these iconic brands. So what was the impact of that deal on the company?
Well, the amazing thing is it bought us time, you know. So when we were really struggling and when we were losing a lot of money on a monthly basis, while Barry was firefighting in that area, it afforded us the luxury of me being able to just focus on product as I always had to that point. But to sit down with the team and make something. And we were really good at making kids' products, and we were really good at taking a brand and interpreting what the underlying brand values were and the value proposition to the customer and bring that to life.
Sorry, what was it exactly that you made with Lego?
So the app we made was called Lego Duplo World, still out these days. I think it's been on the App Store for 5 years now, or 4 years. And it's one of the most successful products that we have. So basically, you go into different environments and play in a sort of contained open world, shall we say, with the characters, and kids basically play with it in user testing, and in, you know, everything we've seen is kids play with it as if they were playing with a set of Lego bricks. They pick up a character, they move the character along, they put the character next to the dog, they laugh when the dog chases it. You know, it's simple stuff, but it's about creating an open play space that the kid can project their own play experiences onto, rather than something with a beginning, middle, and end.
Yeah. So fast forward a little bit after that. The company is acquired, essentially. Was that an easy thing to do or to think about?
So, you know, it's an interesting one, actually. What I would say is as soon as you go from making almost no money to making quite a lot of money, people are interested, right? So we had a few approaches from an acquisition perspective. And I guess, you know, the board of directors at that time had been extremely patient with StoryToys. And by this point in time, I was the CEO of the company, but Barry was chairman of the board. And, you know, they'd been extremely patient with an organization that had burned through millions of dollars of their money over the course of the previous few years. So it seemed an appropriate time. To be fair, they offered the support for continued growth on a sort of and continuing our own journey. But I felt that, you know, they'd all been really patient, and I wanted to see them all exit really well.
Yeah, so it was as much of a liquidity event and a reward for the patients as it was 100%. A strategic move, yeah. Maybe to take advantage
of
a larger
company. That's a part of it, right? But again, like I said, there would have been multiple parties. Whereas when Team 17 turned up, suddenly I was talking to somebody who had been through a similar growth journey with their games company several years previously. So suddenly there was actually somebody to sort of to learn from that had been down that road not that long previously. So that was really important. The company was, you know, was very comfortably profitable at that point in time. So it wasn't like it needed Team 17 from an investment perspective, but in terms of growth, support, advice, all of those kind of things, we very much picked them as the company we wanted to grow under and work with.
And you are still CEO now of StoryToys. So how is the company going now?
The company's doing great. You know, I mean, like, I can talk reasonably openly about this stuff because honestly, anyone with an app, any account can chart exactly how our company's performing. So I'm not, you know, letting the cat out of the bag from a shareholder perspective or anything like that. But, you know, January was the company's best month ever.
How do you define that?
By revenue.
Right.
So by revenue and by downloads. But, you know, primarily, obviously, when you've kind of flown a little close to the sun, you keep a really close eye on revenue in your business from then on. By revenue, January was our most successful month. February, if it had had the same amount of days as January, probably would have been, we haven't done a full tot on March yet, but it may well have been our best month. So we are continuing to grow. It's been a pretty solid growth trajectory, not like hockey stick level, but stable ongoing growth. That's what we've been really focused on.
And any other exciting parts of the company? Did you do business with Marvel?
Yeah, so like one of the key things that Team 17 pushed us towards was diversification. So they bought a company and they're like, right, this is great. We like the fact that you're working with Disney. We like the fact that you're working with the Lego Group, but either of those licensing deals ends, you're losing half your revenue. So they basically, they were very good in terms of, you know, just appropriate common sense guidance. So we have significantly diversified our licensing portfolio. So including the likes of Marvel, Hasbro, Sesame Workshop, Mattel. So we've expanded significantly.
I think I've heard of some of those. Yeah.
Expanded significantly in the last couple of years across the portfolio.
So having been through this journey, Emmett, do you think you would do it again? Was there anything that surprised you about it?
I guess cognitive dissonance suggests to all of us that we look back on our journey and say, no, I wouldn't have done a thing differently. That isn't true. The reality of it is I think there probably are other, there are junctions along the way that you look back on and go, yeah, maybe if we'd approach that slightly differently. And so for me personally, I think the biggest mistake that I made during my time in StoryToys as chief product officer was that I considered somebody else to be responsible for the commercial aspect of the business. And I think this is a very easy thing to do as a creative, is to sort of, or in any business where the roles are separated out, to think of somebody else as owning something else. It wasn't until the point that I became the CEO of the company that I realized I hadn't had enough commercial focus in my creative development. So I guess I bring that up because I think that's a useful lesson for a lot of people in a lot of different businesses, that ultimately, regardless of your role, you are responsible for the money that comes in the door.
That's a really interesting point, and it's a good one on which to leave. Emmett O'Neill, CEO of StoryToys, thank you very much for coming in today. It's been a real pleasure talking to you. And that's all we have time for today. My name is Adrian Weckler. You have been listening to The Big Tech Show. John Smith was on sound, Emmett was our guest, and JJ Clark produced. And we will talk to you soon. Bye-bye.
Seachtain, an Indo as Gaeilge.
Time I mon iarracht I aon of teacht ar a chorp, agus súlagam amach an seo, gur féidir é a chur in uaig ceart lena bhaintir féin.
Scíltaí, fios, tuairimí.
Tá sé dochreite nach bhféadfach ara i gcuir na meán an cheist sin a eicáil.
Bhí an talam ag an am go raibh orthcháir na reachtam. Iadach sé tarrinn gribhan ar chórstan i lis dúhal agus gimine fnacht gór a clig sár ducas in éachar. Nau ni vin aon dar darach sé sin. Vin marav.
Seachtain. Find us on all the usual podcast platforms.